is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Reminder to those that are joining us live, when you get a chance, go ahead and scroll down to the bottom of the show page. You'll find the chat room. And in the course of the show, if you have some observations you'd like to share, or are there some questions for our guests you would like for us to cover in the course of the hour, that's a great place to put it in there, because we'll be monitoring that throughout the show. And if your questions are better than ours, we'll be happy to steal them. And if you're new to Midrats and want to catch up on some previous shows, or you got to pop off halfway through the show and want to see what you missed, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio. That's also a great thing to do if during the course of the show when you're with us live, the audio dies right at the hour. That's okay. It keeps recording in the after show, and that after show is always there over at the archive. You can get the last few minutes. Now let's get on with the show. For thousands of years, I think for those that study the profession of military arms, everybody has been trying to get what we now call joint operations right. It's an ongoing effort, and especially for the U.S., which is, in essence, with a pretty calm north and south border. We are an island nation, but we have significant global interest ashore, and we have a long, rich history of doing joint operations right, with also a fair moment of blind parochialism as well. And we're going to use this as a starting point for a discussion today with a returning guest for the full hour, John Kuhn, Commander, United States Navy, retired PhD. Dr. Kuhn is the General William Schacht Chair for Historical Research at the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. He retired from the U.S. Navy in 2004 after 23 years of service as a naval flight officer in EP-3s and ES-3s. He authored Agents of Innovation back in 2008 and co-authored Eyewitness Pacific Theater in 2008 with DM Giangreco. Also, he's published numerous articles and editorials and was awarded the Mankato Prize from the Society for Military History in 2011. Towards the end of the show, we're also going to discuss his latest contribution to the discussion. At the end of the month, his latest book will be published titled History of Japan, From the Age of the Samurai to the 21st Century. John, welcome back to Midrats. Hey, and that's my fault. By the way, I had you muted, so let me unmute you. There we go. John, okay, sorry about that. Welcome back to Midrats.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Hey, I just got to kick things off here as a scene setter. I've always found it interesting that as a nation, if you want to, you know, put a marker down, you know, our nation achieved its independence and was born at the end of a great joint combined operation with the French at Yorktown. And it's amazing with that type of birth of experience, you know, in George Washington, he talked a lot about what we call now the importance of joint operations, that we're still in an ongoing battle to really get that right and to make sure that we have the right mix. And just as a question for you, is this something that's common to all nations similar to ours, and is it a byproduct of just human nature's tribalism and parochialism and wanting the best for your service, or is it really a structural issue and something that happens to do with our national character?
Okay, if I understand you correctly, you're asking why is jointness so hard for nations?
Exactly.
Why is that a problem? Yeah. Well, it wasn't a problem for the founding fathers. They lived in a littoral nation. They lived in a littoral set of colonies, 13 colonies, and they lived in the in some of the biggest, cleanest cities in the world, outside of out of China, although they were certainly cleaner than cities in China. But and David M. Potter talks about this, but they were seafaring folk. The inside of the nation had not been developed much, so you had these big places like New York, Philadelphia, and Boston, and so the culture was almost entirely centered around ocean-going trade, and that's how most of the money was around and about in the 13 colonies. So, and the colonies had various economic bases for the colonies, but the colonies were overwhelmingly focused toward the sea, with their eyes on the sea for maritime trade and to move goods and services, and also to receive things that was mercantilism back then. So Great Britain demanded that all her colonies buy manufactured goods, hats, pins, boots, stuff like that from her. So that was the economic circumstances, and because of that, the founding fathers all pretty much understood quite correctly that warfare had to include a naval component for their colonies. So the colonies, and it's in the Constitution, establish and maintain a navy. Even though we don't establish and maintain a navy until Stoddard in the 1790s, but 1787 it says that, and then below that, you can raise an army, but only for a period of 2 years. That does not apply to the Navy. Now, it does, all of that stuff now applies equally across the board. But the jointness was there from the beginning. And at Yorktown, Washington clearly understood, as did the British, that sea power was going to be the thing. The reason Cornwallis is where he is because he needs the support of his fleet for logistics. He can't maintain his army in the interior of the Carolinas. It's starving to death. And Washington correctly coordinates with the French in a pretty elegant campaign. I've done the staff walk out, and there's a satellite campus for us in Fort Lee, Virginia, just outside Richmond. And I've done the Yorktown staff ride three times, and we have a couple stands where we talk about the Battle of the Capes and command of the sea and control of the sea. But it was pretty well understood by all three parties there, the Americans under George Washington, the French under Rochambeau, and the British under Cornwallis, that the key here was control of the sea, or if Cornwallis was going to survive, or if Cornwallis wasn't going to survive. And Cornwallis kind of let himself get trapped here because he made the assumption he'd always have the Navy to come bail him out, and in this case he didn't, because the French admiral had driven the British off in this Battle of the Capes. So why don't we go? Why do we move away from that? Well, it has to do with the opening up of the American West, and I think it's each country is different, and that's why the first chapter of Mahan is so important, because he lists six conditions that affect the development of sea power, and the first three are geographical. What your position is, are you like Great Britain right there, where all of Europe's maritime trade is starting to flow out to the New World and into the New World? Are you like Japan right there, between China and the rest of the world? So position matters. Are you Spain? Do you have this position, that gives you positional advantage? Also access. Position and access are the same thing. The second condition actually has to do with, do you have navigable bays, rivers, estuaries, and all that kind of stuff? And so the geographical circumstances are absolutely important for how sea power gets developed. If the United States had just been this long, skinny island that went from Miami all the way up to Boston with nothing else on the other side except another seacoast, then this kind of drift back away from joint sort of warfare probably wouldn't happen. But what happens is the United States becomes a continental power. And so into the whole realm of the American identity becomes this thing of taming a continent. Well, taming a continent is not the same thing as taming the seas. Now, at the same time, we had a maritime culture, a very strong maritime culture. And that culture came back after the continent was tamed. Frederick Jackson Turner wrote his famous book about the frontier thesis. And once we got to the west coast of the United States, there was no more frontier. So the frontier became the seas again, and that was right same year that Mahan's book came out about the influence of sea power upon history. It's one of the great coincidences of history, if you believe in that kind of thing. But then the United States started turning its face towards the sea again. And so you see this kind of up and down with the United States. But for most of its history, the United States has not had, you know, it gets this continental focus, and then it kind of loses that joint flavor. I think the other thing that generally causes a jointness to have difficulties is service cultures. A Navy service culture and an Army service culture are completely different. They really are. There's so many things about maritime power and land power that differ. You know, right there at the interface is where you get the most jointness, and we'll talk about some of those. We already started with one, Yorktown, right there at the interface. But service cultures can lead to that too, because a service, obviously, you know, wars are decided on land, right? You always decide wars on land. Well, what if you're an island and you've got a big navy and nobody can ever invade you? You know, the war that you're going to decide is probably a civil war or a domestic disturbance. So you've always had this sort of tension between nations. Now, the United States, or between services, service cultures. Now, the United States is both. It's a continental power and a maritime power. It's this giant island situated between the Pacific and the Atlantic, with this little teeny isthmus that connects it to the continent below it. And Mexico is not really a threat. I mean, let's face it, they're not really a threat. They're a source of cheap labor. And Canada, give me a break, not a threat. But because of this, the United States has always had sort of this continental view of the world, because it is a continent. But on the other hand, it's this giant continental island. Not quite as extreme as Australia is, but extreme enough so that it's always kind of had the naval component. And so you have these two very powerful sort of service identities. Now, 20th century comes around, you throw in the air culture piece into it. And so you know, and each service has always wanted, they've always kind of wanted to say, hey, well, we're the guys that are going to defend things. We're the guys that are going to keep you safe. And the Navy's always had the attitude, hey, if we have a big Navy, or if we have a powerful enough Navy, we can defend, you know, the Constitution by keeping enemies from invading the United States. The Army, on the other hand, says, well, no, we can defend it. And there were many areas throughout our history before it became a great naval power where they said we can do it with, you know, small flotillas and forts, and we can defend the country that way. And then the air power guys came along and said, well, we don't need a Navy or an Army. We can defend it with air power. We'll sink the ships or do whatever we need to do out over the oceans or out in somebody else's backyard, you know, with long-range aviation. So these service cultures have all kind of said, no, me, I'm the one that can protect you, and that's why jointness is so hard.
Well, you know, as we were talking, I started thinking about the Battle of Salamis and the ancient Greek system, which, you know, we seem to talk about jointness, but in that particular battle, that was an example of jointness long before the American Revolution. But in those days, there weren't really distinctions, I don't believe, between the military leadership of the Navy and the Army. They were not segregated the way we have them in our system. Am I off base in looking back that far in history? I mean, there seem to be a number of examples of joint military operations that we could go to if we look far enough back.
Yeah, they were strategos, generals. So that's who you appointed. Now, they had different names, but again, depending on what the basis of power was for the particular Greek city-state that we're talking about, your strategos would be a navarchate or some other kind of arch. But in Athens, the same guys who would command at sea were also the same guys who would command ashore. So there was that, and this, you know, the same is true of the Romans. The Romans were the same way. They tended to make their generals admirals and vice versa. So you could see a guy like Octavian, you know, would be both at sea and both on land, or Mark Antony would, you know, be at the Battle of Philippi, and then he'd be out at sea again for the Battle of Actium. So it came a little bit more naturally, but you always have to look at what the source of power is for the state. And, you know, at Salamis, the key here is that, you know, the two service cultures are what? They're the phalanx, which who's the dominating force in the phalanx? The best phalanx in the ancient world, of course, the Spartans. They have this highly militarized society, and so if a Spartan phalanx shows up on the battlefield, unless it's incredibly outnumbered, which is what the Persians tried to do, it's going to win just about every time. The same thing is true for the Athenians and their navy. They have the navy. And so, yeah, they defeat the Persians by joint action, both on land and at sea. But then it's kind of the service culture thing takes hold. But in this case, it's city-state culture, and for the Athenians, it was a maritime culture. And Pericles, in his great funeral oration speech, says, hey, here's how we win. We can't beat these guys on land, but we'll have this very, very energetic foreign policy with our navy, gobbling up colonies, conducting raids, kind of nibbling away until they make a mistake. And then the Spartans was like, well, we'll just kind of maintain this power. We'll try to strip away their allies, but we've got this big army. And eventually the Athenians will make a mistake. Fascinating thing about the ancient world is that both of them made the mistake. The Spartans first, and they had to sign the Peace of Nicaea. But then the Athenians made the great mistake in Sicily at Syracuse, where they lost their fleet. So you know, it's what's the basis of power, you know? And so, and the United States' basis of power has been a continental basis coming into the 20th century, but that continental basis wasn't because of the big army. It was because of this huge industrialized economy that by the time of the 1900 rolls around is really the biggest economy on the face of the planet. But it doesn't have a big army. But it does have a fairly large navy. So the United States, you know, you can see the continental piece also comes from that, too, that, oh, we got this big nation full of resources, you know, so that leads to sort of a continental attitude. But we're a continental island, and I think once Americans kind of get used to that and what do you do when you're one of those, and how do you defend it in air and space, how do you defend it in sea, and how do you defend it with an army? Most, you know, do we defend forward? Do we do it with a strategy of preemption, or do we manage the problem? Those are all the sorts of questions you're going to want to ask that way. But that's sort of my answer there, is that the two joint partners turn on each other, and it's a 30 years war in Greece 2,500 years ago.
Eventually, we'll get more recent, but I find the history, especially pre-20th century history, absolutely fascinating, and a part of it was the point you just made. You can go back a few thousand years, and whether you're talking about process, personalities, or actual movements in geography, it's all right there if you take the effort to learn it. And one of the things I wanted to touch on here, for mostly family reasons, I'm more familiar with the Mississippi campaign. We wrote a great article on the triumph of Civil War jointness about some of the operations on the East Coast, especially that the Union forces were able to do. And a question I had for you is, the success that the Union had in doing that, was more of that based upon the personality of the leaders who actually were there, or were there some institutional leadership direction and guidance that helped the Union forces to be able to succeed in those just absolutely cruel joint operations to separate and strangle the South?
That was in Naval History Magazine, the last issue of Naval History Magazine. And I want to make sure everybody understands what the way that article was written was. I had a student a couple years ago, and he was interested in the Civil War, and he wanted to write an article about, he wanted to do a master's thesis. So Mike, Commander Mike Richardson, I think is his name. And so Mike did the master's degree, and I said, Mike, we can turn this into an article for somebody, so why don't we do that? So he and I told him, you know, I'd help kind of wordsmith it and edit it and add some things here and kind of prosify it or whatever from a master's thesis. So that was actually started out as a master's thesis by Mike. And he did a great job, and he's still in the Navy. I mean, he's a commander and everything. So I want to make sure he gets credit for the really good work that he did. Okay, now to answer your question, personalities were huge. But you know, one of the guys is a guy that the only time we ever hear of him is when we think about, you know, George Armstrong Custer and the Little Bighorn, and that's George Terry. So Terry kind of represents sort of the institutionalized piece, but the other personalities are key. One, you need a joint commander. And who is going to make the best joint commander of anybody given, you know, the way the Civil War rolls along, other than perhaps Abraham Lincoln, who actually kind of commands operationally down off Norfolk at one point. He kind of commands at the operational level almost on his own. But it's Grant. U.S. Grant is probably the guy with the most amount of experience. I mean, one of his first big battles is right off the Mississippi River at Belmont in Missouri. And so it's an amphibious landing, and then they're doing pretty well, and then he has to do a retrograde and pull out, kind of ride the riverboat up the way after the Confederates kind of mass against him. But almost his entire career in the West is a joint, it's joint operations in these campaigns, both Henry and Donelson and then the Great Vicksburg campaign, which is really all about stick-to-itiveness. You know, Grant was just an extremely strong willpower, and he just didn't want to give up. And as long as he had the material and the resources, he was going to continue to try to take Vicksburg. Well, during that campaign, he forged a relationship with Admiral David Dixon Porter. And so that relationship is sort of key, I think, for it. I think Farragut could have been in command at Fort Fisher, and it would have worked out just as well, because I think Grant got along with Farragut, and Farragut was really good at getting along with other people. Porter, different story. I mean, he was kind of an interesting guy. He could be very, very good, but he could also sometimes be pretty bad. So personalities counted. But in the Fort Fisher campaign to shut down Wilmington and kind of close the last port for the Union blockade and capture it by capturing Fort Fisher, which controlled access to the Cape Fear River and to Wilmington, they had tried that. In fact, they kind of tried the crater approach. They were going to explode this big ship and blow a hole, you know, in the seawall there at Fort Fisher. And as it turned out, they had a huge disaster with that. That didn't work. And they also tried an initial land assault with good old Benjamin Butler, you know, one of the political generals of the Civil War. And, you know, the only thing he ever did right was, he didn't even do that right, was governor of New Orleans after New Orleans was captured in 1862. But he was a political general, and they had to use him. And at Fort Fisher, he was at first picked to command the expedition, and again, he and Porter didn't get along. He didn't listen to his subordinates. He didn't listen to Porter. They actually got ashore. And then they made the decision, no, this is too hard. We're going to pull back. And the whole thing fell apart in acrimony and finger pointing. And finally, you know, this was like Butler's, you know, third or fourth catastrophe that he had during the war. Finally, Lincoln was able to put him on a shelf and say, you know what, I've got enough political capital. I don't need to worry about picking the Democrats off because of this guy. So they picked another guy, General Alfred Terry, and essentially the joint commander for the campaign is Grant. And then the component commanders are Terry on the land and David Dixon Porter at sea. And, you know, Grant makes sure, hey, listen, you guys have to work together. You have to work together to make this work. So Grant is not on the scene, but he's sort of the JTF commander, you know, back at headquarters, you know, actually with the Army outside Petersburg. So he's kind of saying, you guys have to work together. And then Terry and Porter is really kind of a model that they coordinate so well, and a lot of lessons learned, and just very well done, a very professional effort. And by this point in the war, you know, everybody had become a professional. At the start of the war, professionalism in the Army was very, very low, and the Navy wasn't that much better. But by the end of the war, these guys knew their trade. They knew how to work. I mean, they land, they establish a secure perimeter. They set up another perimeter behind them in case this Confederate division, I think it's Hoke's division, wants to come down behind. And, I mean, so it's really well done, and then the synchronization for the attack is very well done. Not something – Grant tried to synchronize the attack at Vicksburg, and he failed. So synchronizing the attack was – and then there was one mistake turned out, you know, sort of this add-on attack by the Navy against the seawall with Kidder Breeze and those guys kind of failed, but it distracted the Confederates so that the main assault had no problem kind of getting in there. Now, none of this takes away from the fact that Confederates really – fought on the defense quite well, but it really was sort of a model for this kind of operation. Hard fought, bloody, lots of casualties both sides, but in the end it worked out quite well.
when we look at joint operations, one of the things that always struck me is that the and I think this is also true of the Army back in the day of Grant, and is that the Army seems to be much more doctrine-oriented, and the Navy seems to be much more, probably due to the nature of sea battles, much more flexible in its approach to things. Is that a problem in conducting joint operations, since we don't always speak the same kind of doctrinal language, or sometimes the Navy didn't even speak a doctrinal language?
Yeah, I think you're right on that one, Sal. I think, and again, you know, I always tell people, you know, the Navy has doctrine. We just don't use the D word for it. We don't use the doctrine word for it. And much of it is classified. I mean, the Second Fleet Fighting Instructions was doctrine that we used back during the end of the Cold War there. It was absolutely doctrine. But it was classified. And all of our op tasks are normally classified. Naval warfare publications are classified. Even the composite warfare commander concept, which I would posit is sort of been our capstone operational doctrine for the last 50 years, was classified at one point. So a naval warfare pub that was in was classified, but it hasn't changed so much that Navy guys can't understand it, and it's kind of pounded into our DNA what that doctrine is. But it's all about centralized planning and centralized execution, and the navies, the way navies are set up, they have to operate that way because of the environment that we operate in. This sort of close control that you can get with an army, you can't get with a fleet. And once the battle starts, you know, like a Trafalgar or the Battle of the Nile, you know, Nelson's not going to be able to send signals to these guys. And the American Navy operates pretty much the same way the Royal Navy did. So, you know, I've written about this for the Army Mission Command, you know, at the Battle of the Nile and everything. And so you have to have this sort of common understanding. But to say the Navy doesn't have doctrine is not right. But, again, I think it's looser, it's more flexible, because we really give – our commanders at sea quite a bit of flexibility to execute commander's intent. You know, even though we put out, you know, nightly commander's intent message in all the warfare areas, still the bottom line comes down to that commander and his tactical action officers, or that guy in his airplane and, you know, some of his guidelines. You know, he makes the call. You know, you're the pilot in command, you're the mission commander, you make the command. That's the culture of the Navy. Armies have a lot more pieces and parts to keep track of, especially when it comes to human beings. You know, if you don't have this air wing of 70 airplanes, each with a mind of their own, you've got this division with, you know, 15, 16,000 people, each with their mind of their own. So you need a little bit more, and this is what my, you know, 14 years of teaching at the Army Command and General Staff College has taught me. For armies, you do need to have a little bit more you need your doctrine to be a little bit more directive and prescriptive. A lot of the joint doctrine is written by Army guys, you know. So if Navy, you know, one reason, you know, if the Navy guys would like, you know, they want to get into the joint doctrine writing business, that's what they should do. I don't know how that is for your career, but, you know, most of the joint doctrine is written by Army guys, not by Navy guys. Maybe some Air Force guys in there, you know, writing their pieces, you know, about the forward support coordinate, the fire support coordination line official and stuff like that. But most joint doctrine, I would tell you, is probably written by the Army. I think I've answered your question, but, you know, I have a lot of thoughts on doctrine. I don't think the Navy is non-doctrinal. I mean, anybody who knows the composite warfare commander concept, that's our doctrine. Anybody who knows how to operate inside the realm of the scene combat commander and his op tasks, those op tasks are doctrine. Okay, it's pretty flexible, the Navy system, but again, our environment allows us to be that way, and the culture of the Navy always has been that way. One of the things that worries me with the information revolution is too much control, that you're going to start to interfere with what the Army calls mission command, which is the ability of your commanders to kind of broadly understand mission-type orders and execute. That's, you know, when I hear the Army saying, that's what we're going to do, we're going to do mission command, we're going to get broad mission orders, and you'll have disciplined initiative. You'll understand what your commander's end state and his objectives are, but you'll have the initiative within that in a disciplined way to achieve the objective. And I'm like, well, gosh, that's what we always do in the Navy. So they're trying to get towards that, towards some more of that flexibility, but it's a much bigger challenge for them, you know, to control all those moving pieces and parts. Particularly, the more educated, intelligent, and high-tech your forces become, you know, the more firepower and punch they pack. So, I mean, you know, controlling, you know, you've got this classic tension between, you know, tight control of all these moving parts to kind of make all the cats go in one direction versus giving those cats enough initiative to be able to do your intent and get all that goodness that you get from that. It's simply the Navy has fewer pieces. The Army has more. That's the way it works.
I wish I could recall who it was, but there was a commander in the first half of the 20th century who I'm paraphrasing here. He said the command at sea stopped being fun the minute that the teletype came on board ship. I don't think he'd be very happy nowadays.
when he's got 75 bottles with that, right?
Like the Admiral would like to Skype in. Yeah, things have gotten a little different in that respect. Speaking of modern times, in the modern context, jointness, you can kind of draw the thread back to Goldwater Nichols back in the 80s. And back a few months ago, you wrote a real nice piece over at Best Defense on the passing of one of the architects of that, Ike Skelton. Who was Ike Skelton, and why is he important in the discussion of national defense and jointness?
Well, Congressman Ike Skelton from Lexington, Missouri, which was known as Little Dixie back in the Civil War days, because it was very, very southern. So it's one of the most, in terms of cultural heritage, one of the most southern parts of the state. But Congressman Ike Skelton was a defense Democrat. What used to be called as a defense Democrat, and that's how he got into office. Very, very strong on defense. Very, very strong on defense. But then a lot like Harry Truman in terms of his support for domestic programs. So one of those kind of guys, a Scoop Jackson kind of Democrat. But what he thought was that the services just did not work together closely enough. And so he was a big fan of defense reform. And, you know, we had the disaster what was the name of that catastrophe in the desert? Desert One. No, not Eagle One. Desert One with the.
That was my own disaster in the
name.
Desert.
Well, I think it did have Eagle in its name, like Eagle Claw or something like that, but Desert One disaster. And then, of course, the very poorly synchronized effort in Grenada. So, you know, there were all these sort of things and the problems with jointness. And Vietnam had kind of undermined jointness to a great degree because it was very much a compound war of both conventional war in the north and counterinsurgency in the south. So, you know, he was part of that group that said we need defense reform along with Barry Goldwater and Nichols. But his vision, so his first priority was to defend the United States. That was really, he was all about that. You know, he has Whiteman Air Force Base in his district and everything. So this very big Air Force Base there where the B-2s are based. And missiles, you know, we had all these missile silos that used to be here during the Cold War. But he was always very interested in defense reform. And he believed the best way to do it was through education. And so those portions of the Goldwater-Nichols Defense Reform Act in 1986 or 87, it's 86, that have to do with professional military education were really, he was the man with the vision for that, although there are a couple staffers who were really the key guys. But what is now the Officer Professional Military Education Program that mandates that officers will get joint professional military education, both level one, level two, and then get a joint specialty officer qualification before becoming a flag officer. That was Ike Skelton's baby. And he profoundly believed that military history should be a major component of any joint professional military education because he wrote this wonderful article called Whispers of Warriors, where he says it's warriors whisper to us when we study the past. We don't get exact templates for how to do things, but we learn by studying in that environment, not just our history, Army history or Navy history or Air Force history or Marine history, but we learn. We get a feeling, we get an appreciation. So he was a big fan of military history as well. In fact, after the passage of the act, he went around to the to all the PME schools and found that they were still sort of gaffing off the requirement to include a very healthy military history component in their curricula. And he came before Leavenworth, and they were only teaching about 35 hours of history for the whole year, 35 hours. What that equates to is an entire year, and the students were only in the classroom 35 hours with military history. The other 300 hours were doing other things. So he didn't think that was right. So he mandated more history, at least at Fort Leavenworth, but he went around on that. But he was also the guy that said, hey, you're going to get joint professional military education or you're not going to become a flag officer, period. And of the things in Goldwater Nichols, everything else has kind of been watered down over the years. You know, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is supposed to be the president's primary military advisor. And they got kind of watered down, you know. The strongest one we ever had was probably Colin Powell working for President Clinton and also for President Bush, first President Bush. So, and then after that, it just kind of lost its oomph, you know, and the combatant commanders were created and they were given budgets and there were all these things that were done, but jointness was mandated. But I think the reforms that have had the most impact in forcing the services to be joint is joint professional military education. So I wrote that sort of obituary for Ike because you know, I said, well, this is kind of the last thing, the most effective, and it's starting to get watered down. Because he was in Washington, I guarantee you, when he went into the hospital and then died, because he was worried about PME, professional military education, that it was going to take huge cuts in these budget cuts. When in fact, it's probably the most, you know, it's you get the best bang for the buck from education in these service schools, and you know they don't really cost a lot when you think about it. So there was that. I actually got to meet the guy, and I was worried about him. I met him a couple of years ago. It was 4 years ago now, I guess. It was the 60th anniversary of the Korean War. And I met him over at the Truman Library, and Dennis John Greco, my co-author for Eyewitness Pacific Theater, he took me over there, and I got to meet him. I mean, what a gentleman. But he did not look well. I mean, and he was kind of frail. And I thought, man, here's this lion in this body that's given out on him, you know. But he worked hard, and he was really trying to get this thing and keep it up. And I don't know if you know Frank Hoffman, but Frank Hoffman sent an email this week saying, hey, they're looking at PME, you know, right now back in Washington and in Congress, and about, okay, where are we going to cut in PME? How are we going to cut professional military education? So that kind of thing just kind of scares the bejesus out of me, because it was in professional military education that the United States has always been ready when we didn't have the big army or the big navy. At least we had well-trained, well-educated professional officers, either in the Naval War College and then later on in the Army, from the Army War College and from Fort Leavenworth. So, and Maxwell eventually gets in on the PME ticket too. So I really hate to see PME undermined and watered down, particularly the joint aspect of it. The services should send their best guys to the sister service schools for jointness. You know, I mean, you know, I know it's Navy guys want to go to the Naval War College, Air Force guys want to go to the Air Force Air University, and Army guys want to go to Command General Staff College. But I will tell you, they really need to send their best guys to the other schools, and they need to send their best guys to teach in these other schools. They actually decoded these joint billets in 2007 to make room for all these new joint billets in these continental wars over in Asia. So they took away all the joint billets for all of the instructors in the PME system. They just decoded them. Now they're trying to recode them back, but it's not a done deal yet. So there's been Ike Skelton's vision for how to stay joint has taken a lot of hits. I'm passionate on this. This isn't the first time I've talked about this, Sal. I've written two editorials in Proceedings, you know, send our best to Leavenworth, you know, kind of a tongue-in-cheek, you know, sort of thing. And then I sent one a couple of years ago, you know, Navy doesn't value professional military education. And then I wrote something for Armed Forces Journal talking about the Goldwater Nichols fix and how PME is the key to it. And then this last thing with Ike Skelton. So I'm passionate on this. I, I do not want to see JPME become this watered-down, ticket-punching thing that that I fear it could become. Ike Skelton will roll over in his grave over there in Missouri. He might come back with Bill Cantrell and burn the house down.
Well, if my memory serves me right, I think the new vice CNO, Wendell Leavenworth, so you might have an advocate up there in the number two billet. And it just happens to be that these names are all Democrats. But I have
sorry about that. I mean,
No. It's fine because I'm going there too. One of my more colorful relatives back in the home country in Mississippi, he likes to say, I'll use a little salty language here. He said the only Mississippi politician ever worth a damn was Senator Stennis. You know, you look at Ike Skelton, you look at Stennis, and you look at Sam Nunn, and there are a few from the other party as well. There used to be a cohort, it was bipartisan, of senators and congressmen who weren't just advocates for their district, and they weren't just counting the number of jobs, but they really understood national security. They understood the military. Who are the modern versions of our Skeltons, our Stennises, and our Nuns that you can see in the House and Senate? Or is it a little thin there? You know, who's going to replace those lions that used to be there? And on a similar note, Goldwater Nichols could probably use a little bit of tweaking for the 21st century. Do you see anybody that, because ultimately it will have to happen in Congress, anybody have the intellectual capital to begin that movement to improve?
Oh, I think they're out there. The problem is, can we get them into the jobs and the offices? Well, they'd be great. I mean, look at Carl Vinson. I mean, who would have thought, you know, this guy from Georgia.
Another one.
And then he turns out to be just this incredible advocate for naval affairs. And I don't think it has to do with not enough people serving in the military. We've got a buttload of kids coming back from these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan who are running for office. And some of them are getting elected. So I'm not worried about that. But in terms of understanding, you know, the Constitution, what it requires, how to defend the United States, kind of understanding, you know, grand strategy, not strategy, grand strategy, and I've written about that as well. But I think they're there. You know, if you want names, you know, a lot of these people are probably staffers. And they're working for some of the big names. The problem is it's such a polarized political atmosphere right now. And it's, you know, we say this is so much more polarized than it was in the past. And then I go and I start doing my history research on the 20s and the 30s, and I go, wait a second, you know, this is pretty acrimonious and contentious here. You know, people are pointing the finger at this guy saying he's betraying America, you know, and they're pointing the finger at that guy and saying he's betraying America. And Billy Mitchell points the finger at the Navy and says that they're traitorous dogs, you know, and that they should be court-martialed, you know. I mean, the president has to court-martial him. I mean, so some of this stuff isn't new, but there, there's an education piece here, and I'm not sure why the education system doesn't produce people with a more of a global mindset. I mean, my God, this is globalization. The world is globalized. You would think you'd have more of these people rather than fewer of these people out there. But, I mean, there's some talent out there. There's some very talented people. There's some people who know better, who should do the right thing. I do think McCaskill here in Missouri is got a pretty clear head. I don't know how well schooled she is in stuff, but look at Abraham Lincoln. I mean, he came into the hardest job in the world, and you know, I mean, he probably had ever read maybe, you know, Caesar's commentaries. You know, other than that, he probably didn't have much schooling in military affairs. You know, other than, you know, being in a militia unit in the rear in the Black Hawk War, but I mean, he really didn't have any military experience to speak of, and he was a great grand strategist. So you never know what you're going to get. I mean, it's. I think sometimes people rise to the occasion. The American dream, the American ideal is that these people will rise to the occasion, at least at the strategic level. They need to think about the big picture. They need to think larger than life, larger than themselves, larger than their political careers. I think Bob Gates was an incredible guy to have at the helm. I thought he was a wonderful Secretary of Defense, even though I'm on the record, and Gates let me publish while he was Secretary of Defense, of of abolishing OSD and getting the Secretary of the Navy and the Secretary of the Army back into the cabinet, you know, I thought he was a good secretary. I don't think we have been well served by, I don't think we've been that poorly served by the secretaries we have. I think there's some systemic problems in this huge bureaucracy. And that brings up your other question, you know, what about reform? We need lots of reform. We don't need a little bit of reform. We need an almost entirely new Goldwater Nichols. And say, okay, you know, how do we make this thing work? Because it's not, you know, it's not getting to where we want. We're watering down the PME, you know, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is sometimes, you know, sort of a water boy, and at other times, you know, he has a say, he has a seat at the table, and it's dependent on personalities, president, you know, why doesn't the NSC work, you know, what's wrong with that? So there's a lot of reform that's needed, and this is the time to do it. I mean, this is... If I was going to take you back in history style, I'd take you to 1919. Okay, now, we're not coming back from a couple wars where we didn't, you know, win. I don't know if you can say we lost, but we certainly haven't won. And we're coming back from World War One. It's kind of a – it's such a flawed peace, though. Of course, we don't even sign the peace treaty. But they take this 4-million-man army and take it down to 120,000 guys. They take the Navy and they said, you can't build any more capital ships for the next 10 years. And then 10 years later, they say, you can't build any more for the next 5 years. You can only build this many aircraft carriers. You can only have this many ships. I mean, there are these things put in place. And that's, you know, and everybody looks at that. Well, that's horrible. But that's when some of the best innovation was done. And that was the time for reform. We had a National Security Act of 1920 was a very profound sort of security act. And then everybody said, well, we're not joint enough. And then it turned out what they thought jointness was we'll make a unified service and we'll make air power the centerpiece of our strategy. And the Morrill Board in 1925 rejected that. They said, no, that's not what defense of the United States should look like with the Navy and the Army basically as a Coast Guard and a constabulary force and this big, giant Air Force. Thank God. It would have turned out horrible for us in World War II if that had been the case. So, you know, there's all these myths about, you know, how well we've done and how poorly we've done, but we need reform, and we need a lot of it. And I think there's some movement for reform, but the country's got so many other problems. But I think the military can get out in front of this. And there's a lot of really good writing being done on military reform right now and how to handle this. I mean, everybody says, don't waste this like we've wasted it in the past. I mean, after the Cold War, we didn't really do a very good job of trying to figure out what we needed to look like. We just kind of said, well, let's just keep doing more of the same. And the op tempo never went down. And we were at this wartime op tempo, you know, all the way until today. You know, it's a wartime op tempo. I know some people say, well, no, it's not a wartime op. It has been. We were at a wartime op in 1991, and it got intense, and then still intense, but not as intense. And I mean, planes, ships, tanks, you know, break, you know, and we're going through this stuff, and now we need to recapitalize everything. So it's a great time for reform. But I certainly think, yeah, we're ready for not tinkering with Goldwater Nichols, but major reform that keeps the goodness of Goldwater Nichols in place.
You know, you just talked about the writing on reforming the military. One of the things I've been reading is people who want to abolish the Air Force, which seems to me to be a very limited approach to encouraging jointness. But as we go into a modern era, and we have we're just at the beginning of unmanned weapon systems and stuff like that. You know, the Air Force made a big run to get the unmanned aerial vehicles under their sway. How much impact is that kind of future going to play on our joint operations?
Well, unmanned's a big deal. I mean, every operational construct being discussed today has the unmanned component in it. The Strategic Studies Group up there in Newport under Jim Hogg calls it the unmanned imperative. Well, what do those words mean? It means we're going to have to use unmanned technologies in future wars. I mean, we've been using unmanned technologies for how long? I mean, the bullet is an unmanned technology, right? Okay, so that torpedo is an unmanned technology, right? The cruise missile is an unmanned technology. You know, and the Japanese used manned unmanned technology. That's what the kamikaze was. So So it's not like this is anything new. It's just the sophistication and the level of cognition of the machines has gone way, way up. And I've got an article coming out on that. I don't know if anybody's going to publish it. I tried to win a prize with it, you know, that proceedings prize essay thing for, you know, how do unmanned technologies and OODA access apply to Navy culture. I mean, it was everything in the kitchen sink, you know, plus the garbage, you know. But I tried to write on that. But that's a good question to ask, because I actually wrote an essay on it. So I think unmanned's huge. But the thing with unmanned is unmanned where? You know, unmanned in space, unmanned over the oceans, how far up, how far down under the waters, unmanned on the surface of the waters, unmanned on land, unmanned on air over land. And I think we have to be careful about saying, hey, if it flies, I own it. That's what Goering did, right? And German naval aviation performed abysmally in World War II because there was no German naval aviation, because Goering says if it flies, I own it. That's not going to work. Now, certainly the Air Force has roles and missions. And I'm like, I'm with you, so I think it's very intemperate to get rid of the Air Force. The Air Force is here to stay. It's been institutionalized. There's a lot of goodness in the Air Force. Is it a single mission service anymore? No, it's not. It's not just about strategic bombing anymore. But certainly the need for air power over land is big, and you need smart people thinking about it a lot. And, you know, there's these interfaces, and that's the problem here is these interfaces, the land-sea interface, big problem, right? The interface between air-breathing assets and then space assets, big, you know, who owns that? So there's always going to be sort of some fighting over turf on those interface areas. You know, do the Marines have this piece, you know, or does the Army have this piece? Does the Navy have this piece, or do the Marines have this piece? You know, that's always going to be a problem, though, the interfaces between these different media. And then there's the mother of all media, the media that goes everywhere, the electromagnetic wave, and that's the cybernetic world. And, you know, who's going to own that? Everybody's got their own cyber guy, you know, and who's cybercom, you know, and that's all coming into sway. And that's everywhere, you know, and are we going to parcel it out? Well, this is one of those things that boundaries don't work too well, you know. So nobody wants to be left out because, you know, this might be the next big thing. Everybody's always thinking, where's the next big thing, you know? Do we want to let the Navy have cyber, you know? What if it's the next big thing? Or do we want to let the Air Force have cyber? What if it's the next big thing? So you always get a lot of this going on with these sorts of things that cause problems. But and cyber is going to be huge for unmanned because the way you're going to control all these things is with cyber. You can control them with data links. You know, you're going to control them with, you know, pulsed energy. You're going to do all this kind of stuff, all this gee whiz stuff. But unmanned doesn't have to be expensive. It does not have to be expensive. That's where we're going to have to be really careful. I think you can come up with some cheap, implementable operational solutions without, you know, getting these gold-plated marshmallows, you know. So I think we can be smart about this. And, again, we're going to have to be because the money's not going to be there. You know, the kind of extra money that we've had for the last 12 years to throw at the problem of combating terrorism is not going to be there anymore. Americans feel a little bit safer now, okay, even though they've had to trade away a lot of civil liberties to feel that way. So I think unmanned will be huge.
Yeah, I think that's one of the critical things that a lot of people are starting to get hold of now, but not enough, is the fact that, you know, there's always the theory that strategy should drive budgets. Well, you know what, shipmate, for a while, budgets are going to have to drive strategy, whether we like it or not. Just kind of whipsaw us completely before we run out of time. I just realized where we were in the course of the hour.
I thought I'd lose my voice.
Well, I want to get you energized here because I know you've invested a lot of intellectual effort into this, and I wanted to tap into it. And we've all been watching, and I think it really, at least for me, the turn took place after 9/11 when Japan went ahead and went through the Straits of Malacca and sent some ships to help us out, replenishing mostly, but also a destroyer in the Indian Ocean. And they actually were, they offered to do other things that didn't wind up working out. But Japan's confidence has been growing, their self-confidence. They've been looking again and again at how they utilize their military. And in the research of your upcoming book, say it again, A Military History from the Age of the Samurai to the 21st Century, What were items in researching Japan's military history kind of tickled your intellect, those things that might inform us today as we watch Japan build?
Well, it's that old French proverb, you know, sous ne plus changer, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Korea stabs towards Japan like a knife. And I mean, the very first chapter, in the second century after the birth of Christ, we already see nomads coming across from Korea and intermingling and invading, if you will, Japan proper. And eventually Japan goes the other way and sets up influence in Korea. And they do it because I think they're sort of in their DNA that they had this invasion back before recorded history, and they're worried about it. So Korea, Japan, China, there's always been that trilogy in Northeast Asia. It's huge, and it's huge today, and it was huge 2,000 years ago. So that emerged, and Japan's security policy, she created this army, which was a template, really, of the Chinese army called through these things called the Taiho reforms, and it was all about defending Japan against an invasion by one of the Chinese dynasties, either the Han dynasty or the Tang dynasty. And they were always worried about Korea, that Korea was sort of the buffer zone. And so Korea, throughout two millennia, has been Japan's buffer zone to protect herself from her continental neighbors. This happened again with Japan when the Mongols invaded. They invaded two times. The first time they invaded, it was no kamikaze. They landed in Kyushu, but it was more of just sort of a punitive expedition. The Japanese had been rude to their emissaries, and they just kind of landed in Kyushu and started marching and defeating the samurai everywhere they went. And then they got on their boats, and because the Mongols hadn't finished conquering the rest of China, so they put everybody on their boats and went and conquered the Southern Song Dynasty and then implemented the Yuan Dynasty. So that scared the bejesus out of the Japanese, so that at the end of their own civil war, which was the Sengoku, their time of troubles, the Warring States period, if you will, the second great warlord, Hideyoshi, invaded Korea. He was going to fix the problem once and for all by establishing a buffer state in Korea. The invasion went so well, he said, well, I'll invade China. And he got all the way up to Pyongyang, and the Ming Dynasty sent down this huge army with, you know, 200 cannon, surrounded him in Pyongyang and blew him to pieces, blew his army to pieces, the samurai to pieces, and essentially ejected the Japanese using a joint campaign, by the way, with a Korean admiral and some Ming, this was the Ming Dynasty, and they throw him out. So Korea has always been this point, the sticking point. Well, Japan kind of goes back across and then shuts itself off for 250 years. 250 years of relative peace in Japan, although lots of starving people too. But when she opens back up again, where's the first place she goes? Korea. You know, let's set up a buffer zone in Korea, you know, to protect ourselves from the Chinese who are, you know, and then it's a buffer zone in Korea to protect themselves from the expanding Russian Empire. And, you know, how much is enough? You know, they get buffer zones in Manchuria and then buffer zones in North China. They can never get enough buffer zone, you know what I mean? Sounds like the Soviet Union a little bit, doesn't it? Well, they lose World War II and they're back in their thing. And now the buffer zone is policed by their ally, the United States. Well, today, you know, it's the same thing today. You know, the Koreans are still, the animosity towards the Japanese is incredible, as you know. But that's not a new animosity. That's a 2,000-year-old animosity, I'm here to tell you. And the distrust of the Chinese in Japan is a 2,000-year-old distrust. And the annoyance of these Chinese empire after empire, the Han, the Song, the Tang, the Ming, the Yuan, you know, the Qing, all these guys, they've always been annoyed with Japan. You know, they call them dwarf pirates, you know, this sort of nasty thing that they call the Japanese to disesteem them because they don't have a lot of protein in their diet, or dip. Well, look at Chinese strategy today. First island chain, dominate the first island chain. Well, who owns most of the first island chain? Japan, you know, it's Japan and the Ryukyus. That's the first island chain. And then you go on down and you get to the Philippines. Okay, so Japan is so important. They are just so important. I get into this in chat. You know, you get this from the history, the military history. It's really a narrative history. You get this thing about China, Japan, and Korea. But the last chapter is really more of a policy chapter talking about how Japan kind of finds its way back to rearm them. But if I was in Japan, I'd try to get a little cocky, too. I mean, you know, they've been threatened. It's a sensitive situation, and the Japanese have a lot more military oomph than most people realize. I did this Navy League speech a couple years ago, maybe about 7 or 8 years ago. Went down to a Navy League luncheon in Kansas City, and I was talking about our allies in the Pacific, and I talked about the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force. And I was telling these guys, you know, hey, Japan is one of our major allies in the Pacific. They are hugely important. They have one of the most capable navies in the world. I'd put them in the top five. And in the Pacific, they're in the top three. And this old guy comes up to me afterwards and goes, are you telling me, and again, I have to apologize to Japanese-American audience out there, but he comes up to me and uses an expletive, you know, that they used to use in World War II about the Japanese. He says, are you telling me that the J blanks have got a navy again? And I said, yes, sir, they do. And it's good, you know. And he goes, how the hell did we let them do that? But you know, Japan is our pillar, is one of our pillars for strategy in the Far East. And so Japan is hugely important, and sometimes I worry that people don't understand how important Japan is. So it doesn't surprise me that Japan, you know, gets a little worried that we might honor our obligation to them with the Mutual Defense Treaty, you know, the San Francisco system as it's known, you know, that they might get a little bit. Now, do the Japanese make mistakes? Sure, when your acting sitting prime minister goes to the Yasukuni Shrine, where the spirits of all the great warriors are, including war criminal warriors, that's not good, you know. And that shrine, it's in my book, I talk about why they built it. That thing is an icon to militarism. You know, they should have torn that thing down when we occupied Japan in 1945, because it has caused problems ever since.
Well, I think you note in the start of your book that Japan, from the very beginning, has identified itself as a military, I think, you know, created by the sword or spear, as the case may be. You know, we're running over.
Actually, the bow and arrow.
The bow and arrow, right. I really appreciate, and I know Sal does too, appreciate you coming on with us today. It has been an extremely fast hour. I highly recommend that people get your book. I know it's you can get it on pre-order now on Amazon. It'll be out about at the end of the month completely. So, I've started reading it. It's excellent. And I look forward to finishing it up. What else you got in the pipeline that you want to talk about before we let you go?
Well, this is the big project. I'm trying to work on a project right now about the Napoleonic Wars. So I'm working with Prager on that, but I haven't signed a contract. But it's basically an operational history of the Napoleonic Wars, looking at the campaigns and trying to get a hold of this elusive thing that we call operational art. Really looking at the campaigns all the way from 1792 to 1815. Obviously, we're trying to get this thing out by 2015. So I'm doing that, and that's an area that I've always loved. I did one of my master's degrees on Napoleonic warfare, so I'm looking forward to writing that, but I haven't signed a contract yet. I also want to finish a one-volume history of the General Board of the Navy. I've been working on that. I've got a proposal into somebody who shall remain unnamed because I don't want to put them on the spot. So I'm trying to do that. So one book coming out, two in the pipeline, and then all the sort of articles and book reviews and bloviating that I do in my usual locations with the usual suspects.
Well, that sounds like two excuses at a minimum to give you a call back, John. It's been a great hour. Plus, I really appreciate you taking time today, and I wish you the best of luck with your book rollout.
Thanks so much, Sal. Thanks so much, Eagle One. I'm looking forward to it coming out myself. I appreciate that.
And thanks, everybody, for joining us.
Thanks for joining us.
We'll see you again for our next episode of Midrats. Until then, have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Cheers.
Friend and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. dearly, farewell.